broadband internet service providers in Real Simple Syndication are proud to bring you
Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night. That is Jordan.
And that over there is Carlin.
And today we're going to be tackling a fan request.
Yes.
A little film we like to call The Thomas Crown Affair. Not the original.
Not the original. The original was from 1968. We're going to be talking today about the 1999 version. I would love to track down the 1968 version to see what the differences are. This film was actually requested by my friend Jason Chalou. So shout out to you, Jason. I hope you like our review of this and what we come up with. Let's go ahead and take a quick look at the Netflix summary and then just dive into the particulars here. This remake of the 1968 classic shows Pierce Brosnan as the titular billionaire who, for kicks, would rather steal works of art than buy them. It was directed by John McTiernan, who was really more famous for his earlier work as a director than his later work.
Oh, yeah, he did a lot of stuff that people will know.
Yeah, you look very excited about some of his selections.
He did Predator.
Yes, he did.
He did Die Hard.
Yes, he did.
He did The Hunt for Red October.
He did.
And a film I really like, which isn't like a good film, but it's fun, Last Action Hero.
So he had as a filmmaker, he has a pretty good pedigree. As a person, he doesn't. He just recently served some jail time.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Is he Roman Polanski?
No, actually, his was for wiretapping.
What?
Yeah, he was apparently using a private investigator to wiretap his wife.
Oh,
yeah.
Trust issues?
Yeah, but oddly enough, he had time while he was in white-collar jail to write a script for a sequel to The Thomas Crown Affair.
All right. Thanks, jail time.
So we'll see what comes of that.
Oh, geez. That's something else.
Yeah. I can't get over it. Oh, my
That's
goodness.
Awesome. We'll go ahead and talk about the actors involved, and then I would like to talk about the writers involved.
Okay, fantastic. So Pierce Brosnan was Thomas Crown, as the Netflix summary mentioned. He's done a lot of work in both TV and movies. Of course, his most famous TV role was his breakout role as Remington Steele.
And I remember watching Remington Steele because my mom was a Pierce Brosnan fan, and when I was living with my folks, she would always watch Remington Steele, so I would watch along with her. And I'll admit, I kind of liked it.
For the 80s, it's a great show for what was going on. My mom was a big fan of Remington Steele as well, and would not really watch it much when I was around.
She got a little hot and bothered by
I don't know
Pierce.
If she did or not, but she like when we got older, she would mention, oh yeah, Remington Steele, that was a great TV show. And then also he did a mini series version of Around the World in 80 Days, which was really good. I really enjoyed that when I got to see that. In terms of cinema, film, some of his work that people would be familiar with would be The Lawnmower Man, which is a classic science fiction movie. He also was James Bond for several movies.
I didn't like any of his James Bond films, although I hear that Goldeneye is pretty good, and I didn't see that one, but I saw a bunch of the other ones.
Yeah, Die Another Day. That's not one of his. There's one that starts off with him being tortured by the North Koreans.
Well, I don't know if it was this one. The World Is Not Enough?
That might have been it.
Interestingly enough, that came out in 1999 as well.
Yeah.
Same year as Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah. Well, that movie was, like, the first half of it was good, but then there was, like, I think that was the same movie that had Halle Berry and the Ice Palace in it.
Sounds accurate.
Yeah, and it kind of fell off about halfway through the movie. The quality just fell off the boat completely. But the first half of it was a great Bond movie.
So it was like Transformers.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. But another movie that he did very recently was The World's End, which was the last movie in the Coronado trilogy.
Yeah. He did well in that film. I really enjoyed his role, and that was a fun film.
It was. The first two-thirds of it were really good, and then the ending kind of just fell apart.
Yeah, the end wasn't so hot, but the rest of the movie was good enough, in my opinion.
Yeah. Another actor that was in this movie was Renee Rousseau. She played kind of the antagonist in the film, slash love interest, Catherine Olds Banning. And she's been in a lot of different movies. A lot of movies that I looked at her when I was looking her up on IMDb, and I'm like, really? I don't. She was in Lethal Weapon 3.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's also in Get Shorty. And she was in both of the Thor movies, Thor and Thor The Dark World.
That's right, she was.
Yes, as Thor's mother. So
I saw the first Thor, not the second one, yet. I'll see the second one.
I have a sneaking suspicion, my personal pet theory about Thor The Dark World, and it was not a movie I liked, personally.
Yeah.
But my personal suspicion is that it's the crossover movie between the Disney, like Disney-owned Marvel Universe and the Disney-owned Star Wars Universe that we were all looking for.
Okay.
Dennis Leary was Detective Michael McCann, and his character was interesting in this movie, mostly because he spent his time just wandering around going, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did make a very poignant comment at one point that I will talk about later.
Yeah, but he was essentially, him and the rest of the police department were there just for window dressing.
Yes.
It wasn't really meant for anything else. And then also, we talked about this on Chinatown a little bit, but Faye Dunaway was in this movie. She had a cameo as Thomas Crown's psychologist.
Yeah.
And she was the original love interest in the original Thomas Crown affair from the 1960s. So it was, I thought that was an interesting way to work her into both movies.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I felt like the psychologist scenes kind of muddied the story a little bit. So we'll talk about that later, I'm sure.
Oh, man, I was hoping that with Dennis Leary, you were going to say one of the films he was in prior. Suicide Kings. Really good film, and his character in Suicide Kings is great, and he does a really good job playing it. I want to do Suicide Kings. I don't know if it's available on Netflix.
I don't know. I haven't looked that one up to see if it is.
It's a good film. Christopher Walken's in it, too. Yeah. You know, I mean, come on.
How
can you not, like, Johnny Galecki is in it?
Yeah, with that kind of pedigree. Yeah.
Jay Moore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's phenomenal. Sean Patrick Flannery also in it, who's in Boondock Saints. I mean, okay, sorry. I'll stop nerding. I really like that movie.
Well, another thing that I wanted to mention was that the Thomas Crown Affair, this version of it, the original version, I thought this was interesting, was about a billionaire who would perform bank heists. He wasn't actually going in and stealing them himself, but he was like planning the bank heists. But in this version, they thought that someone who was filthy rich stealing a lot of money would just be unsympathetic.
Right.
So they went with the art thieving as an exchange for money thieving.
And he's really just a thief for sport.
Yeah, it's, well, we'll it's talk.
Like, can I get away with it?
We'll talk more, a little bit more about Thomas Crown's personality. But I did want to mention the paintings that were specifically mentioned in the film, because there's some pretty great works of art here. We had San Giorgio Maggiore at Dusk by Claude Monet. Weed Stacks, also by Claude Monet. Noon Rest from Work After Millet by Vincent van Gogh. The Artist's Garden at Aragni by Camille Pissarro. The Son of Man by René Magritte. And this is the one that really kind of defined the movie in a lot of ways. It wasn't the one that was stolen, but it was very prominently featured. And then also Banks of the Seine at Argenteuil by Edouard Manet. Yeah, and this is the second one that was stolen.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the writing for this film, the original script was written by Alan Trustman, and that was obviously used as the material for the rewrite.
Right.
And Alan Trustman had also written the movie Bullet with Steve McQueen in it.
Oh, nice.
So that was a big deal. So I just thought I'd mention that. There were two screenwriters involved in doing the Thomas Crown Affair 1999 version. The first was Kurt Wimmer, and he wrote scripts for Salt, Equilibrium, Sphere, and is currently, or completed, the remake of Point Break that is being done.
Really?
And will be out in 2015, apparently.
So he's got a pretty strong film pedigree right there.
Except the fact that Sphere sucked.
Yeah, Sphere did suck.
I loved the book.
The book was so much better. I felt like the movie was a more violent remake of the Andromeda Strain.
Yeah. And I'm a big Michael Crichton fan. I've read a lot of his stuff, and I really enjoy it. And Sphere was one of my favorite books. So yes. When the film came out, I saw it immediately, and I was very pissed because it was terrible.
Yeah. That's one of those movies where we talked about Nick Fury from Avengers, phoning it in.
Yes.
Samuel L. Jackson. That was another movie where he kind of phoned it in.
Well, he probably knew the script was bad.
Yeah.
And the other screenwriter that was involved in this was Leslie Dixon, and she did Hairspray, really? Mrs. Doubtfire, and Pay It Forward.
You know, wasn't Pierce Brosnan in Mrs. Doubtfire too?
Yes, he was.
Yeah. So they probably were working together based off of that, because Brosnan was actually one of the producers for the Thomas Crown Affair as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
In fact, he and the rest of the producers handpicked the director to do this. It wasn't the director's... it wasn't his vision. It was actually Brosnan's vision, okay. Which is really interesting. But he did make some changes that added some drama to the movie, in my opinion.
The fact that Dixon wrote Mrs. Doubtfire was kind of ironic to me, because while I was watching the film, I found myself saying, some of this music sounds like it's from Mrs. Doubtfire. And I was like, oh, Dixon wrote Mrs. Doubtfire. That's very ironic.
Very ironic.
And on that note, why don't we talk immediately about the music in the film?
Oh, my God.
Terrible.
It was awful.
It was so overstated. It was corny. It was over the top.
It was, I had written down, like, three notes. Like, my third note written down is, the music is dated. It's pure, straight-up 90s music, and in not the good way. Because, a lot of 90s rock holds up very well because they backed off of the production values of the 80s. Because the 80s, the music was very overproduced, in my opinion. A lot of good songs, just not a lot of great production choices.
Right.
But here, they were using a lot of similar production choices that made the music too obvious and really annoying, honestly.
It was beyond annoying. And my wife was watching the film with me, and she said, when I take notes, I don't talk to her about, if we're watching a film together, I don't right. talk to her about what I'm writing down. But it's always interesting to me when she'll say something that I've written down. And in this instance, she was like, the music is terrible. And I was like, oh, that's funny, because that's one of the first things I wrote down on my notes, is that the music is so bad and over the top. And it sucks, because it really detracted from a lot of the film.
It did. I think the film would have gone over better with a more like classical score.
Yeah.
Especially considering that you're dealing with art from the 1800s. Yeah. Something a little bit more refined, impressionist. So why not choose a musical style that relates more to impressionist art rather than kink, like just gooky stuff from the late 90s?
Yeah, it was bad.
And one of the things was that one of the songs that they chose was Windmills of the Mind. I believe that was the title of it. But that movie had been popularized by the original 1968 movie.
Okay.
So they were trying to work that in as another tie back to it. But Sting did not nail it at all.
He wasn't quite walking through fields of gold on that one.
No, he wasn't. No. You know, his funny friend was his voice in that song.
Well, the movie starts out with Pierce Brosnan being, as I like to say, therapized upon by Faye Dunaway's character, who I don't think has a name.
No, the therapist.
Yeah, the therapist.
The therapist.
And one of the initial quotes that you get from him, she's talking about relationships.
Yes.
And he said, a woman can trust me as long as her interests aren't too contrary to my own.
Yeah. And that's actually like the first note that I wrote down too, was that Crown's idea of trust, that as long as people...
get out of my way.
Yeah. Or they don't run counter to his goals.
Right.
His idea of trust is a very common sentiment in today's society. You know, yeah. As long as these people do what I want them to do, as long as they have similar goals to me, I can trust them implicitly. Right. But it's very interesting that... why does someone... It's a very interesting character statement that Thomas Crown is seeking the advice of a therapist when he lives such a high-risk life. You know?
Right.
You know, there's something in his life that he's missing that he's trying to find, but he can't.
Honestly, when you think about the entirety of the film and how it builds the character of Thomas Crown...
Right.
The therapist... aspect of this film seems to not fit.
Right. Not at all.
Because he is so suave and confident and at no point lets on to any sort of like realistic problems. Vulnerabilities
yeah.
or issues. Yeah. He gives you the distinct idea that he is 100% confident in everything he does.
Yeah.
Now I know that there are people who act that way, but then behind closed doors they are seeing therapists. But within the context of the film, it just didn't seem right.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy who blows $100,000 on a golf shot.
Yeah. Yeah, gambling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, I've got all morning. We can do this as long as you want. Yeah. And then, but I mean, that kind of behavior also exemplifies, you know, a need to try and control the situation and also a bit of a sense of boredom in his own life.
Right, so. and that's obvious because, you know, between having to gamble on putting a golf ball and stealing works of art
right.
just for kicks, you know, it's obvious that he's bored. So he's kind of like, you know, I've got all this money. I'm so successful. Everybody knows who I am pretty
right.
much.
Right,
what
right.
else can I do now to get some exhilaration?
And essentially his business is to purchase other people's business.
Yes.
You know, he doesn't work for a living. He just sits in a boardroom and mocks other people as they sign over their life's work.
Which honestly is a very funny and fun part of the movie. I think that they did an extremely good job in the beginning of the film putting together Thomas Crown as a character.
Yeah. Thomas, and he's a very interesting character too.
Yes.
He's a lot of fun to watch because he's sitting in the boardroom just kind of tapping his pen, just waiting for people. And... It's set up pretty early on that he never sells anything that he purchases. Once he acquires it as part of Crown Acquisitions, it stays yeah. within the fold.
It is lock and key, not going anywhere.
Right. But then he decides to sell one piece of property, and it's not really specified what it is. But the investor who's purchasing it sits there with a cigar in his mouth and a match waiting to be lit. And he as soon as Crown writes his name on the contract, strikes the match and lights it. He's like, ha-ha, I've won this one.
Yeah, he's like, oh my God, Thomas Crown actually sold something. I win. To which he basically says, oh, well, you paid $30 million higher than our next highest bidder.
Right.
So,
right. Thanks for your money. Bye-bye.
And then they get pissed off.
Yeah.
Obviously. But that's an interesting exercise in expectations.
Yes.
You know, and negotiations as well. And that kind of stuff happens yeah. with, like, car dealers.
Oh, yeah.
When you go in, it's all about having to do the negotiation. And most likely someone's getting screwed.
Well, I mean, just as a side note about car dealers, there's always the stereotype that car dealers are sexist. Will sell a woman a car for much more than they'll sell a man a car. You know? So there is that aspect, you know, we're going to go ahead and try and force someone to purchase something for more than they really should. And that kind of comes through in Thomas Crown's personality.
But the way that Thomas Crown is in the beginning of the film really endears himself to people immediately because he's sly and suave and confident, but at the same time, he's not an ass about it.
Right.
He doesn't speak a whole lot, at least in the beginning. He's very soft-spoken about it. He's just kind of more like, well, you know, you got screwed.
But the way that he treats all of his employees and all, and like his personal assistant at home, and later we find out his the girl that he's a guardian of,
yes.
He treats everybody with a certain amount of respect, yes. Which is very nice to see a character who's so devilish to come across as being someone who genuinely cares about people as well.
And this is another instance of a film where the main character is not a good person.
Right.
I mean, in certain ways he's a good person, but in other ways he's a thief, and he's, you know, playing this game of cat and mouse, and he's a womanizer, and, you know, all these bad things, but everybody is rooting for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everybody's rooting for him because he's James Bond.
Yeah. You know?
That's the thing. I mean, he's James Bond without being a spy in this movie.
But in the same year, a James Bond film that he's in came out.
So exactly.
I guarantee that actually helped Thomas Crown Affair with its viewership.
Most likely it did. It's something that I wrote down. For Brosnan, if you're going to be typecast, it's not bad to be typecast as the suave gentleman. You know, think about that. I mean, you get to wear nice suits, you get to drink nice wine, you get to, a lot of your scenes are dancing with models, you know. it's a pretty good life to be Pierce Brosnan, no matter what the film role.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Yeah.
Which he was in the very first Percy Jackson film.
Yeah.
And he did a good job in that.
I actually didn't see that one. I haven't read the Percy Jackson books.
I haven't read the books. I saw the two movies. The first movie I enjoyed. The second movie was worth seeing once, but significantly less interesting than the first.
Well, part of his morning routine is that he stops by the Metropolitan Museum of Art and always takes a look at this one particular painting, the one that he actually winds up stealing.
Mm-hmm. In the very end.
In the very end, yeah.
Because at first, he steals the one that he's not looking at.
Right.
It's to the right of him.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting misdirection.
The reason that he steals the one at the very end isn't because he likes that one. He steals that one to get to Catherine.
Right.
You know, so there is a little bit of misdirection going on there.
Yeah.
But he's... He's great because he leaves his briefcase in the room, and really what the briefcase is a titanium reinforced doorstop. The film opens up with him going about his daily business, and that's counteracted with this very elaborate middle-of-the-day art heist, which is just designed to fail.
Well, Trojan horse, anyone?
Oh, my God.
I mean, they couldn't have been more obvious about it. Yeah. Jordan's pointing to his nose is very on the nose.
It's too cute. It's really too cute.
It's just too obvious.
Yeah.
You know, when restrain yourself, filmmakers, when you have opportunities like that, if it's so obvious, then just don't do it.
Right. And I think while the film does a great job of setting up Thomas Crown as a fun character, it does a horrible job of setting up the premise of the movie.
It also does a horrible job of creating any other characters.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's Thomas Crown, and he's the only one that matters.
He's the only one that matters. Everybody else is kind of a two-dimensional paper mache.
They're all flat Stanley.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody is flat Stanley. The guards at the museum are hopelessly, idiotically careless. They're like,
So are the police officers involved.
The police officers, Catherine is, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is that the entire first act of the movie is Thomas Crown stealing this painting. And it's a mediocre set piece.
Right.
Because, like you said, there's the Trojan horse aspect where they sneak in a fake horse statue. That's like,
yeah. Well,
literally, they sneak in a horse statue that was supposed to be a sarcophagus but got mislabeled.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they turn off the air conditioning units in the room that they want to steal because that's going to mess with the cameras. That I thought was pretty cool. That was the only smart thing that they did.
That was an interesting aspect of it.
But the only reason that they did that was so that Thomas Crown could sneak in later and steal it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Then they decide we're going to dress up as museum employees and force everybody out of the exhibit,
which was something I had a big problem with, because they dress up as like the security guards there at the museum, and I wrote down, could they look any more like criminals when they're doing this? Like, they're walking through, they're like mean mugging everyone, and just like, they're not trying at all to look like they even fit in there. They're just kind of like scowling at everyone and like pushing people and stuff like that.
And they're scuzzy looking people. Yeah. They don't look like they've bathed in a couple of weeks.
Well, they've been in the Trojan horse.
Right, exactly. Who knows how long they were in that horse. And then they're just like pushing people out of the way, and apparently they don't know that Crown is their employer,
right?
Because when he comes back to quote unquote look at the exhibit, they push him away and say, don't go in there. So he goes and he finds his favorite curator and goes, yeah, the Impressionist exhibit is closed. They're apparently doing cleaning.
Yeah. And then that's when all the craziness starts.
Right.
But while everything's getting nuts, one of the big issues I have is this is when Thomas Crown steals his first piece of artwork.
Right.
He, as you talked about, put a briefcase in the way of the gate system.
Right.
But there are people running all over the place.
Someone would have noticed that.
Exactly. Who does not see a person get down on the ground and shimmy under a gate?
In a $5,000 business suit.
And do it twice.
Because
he had to do it to get in and do it to get out. And you see people's feet going all over the place in the background.
Yeah.
Somebody would have seen it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, that they don't screen everybody in the museum to see if anybody saw anything is just absolutely bug nuts.
So there are a lot of kind of plot holes.
Yeah.
Small plot holes. Well, no. I mean, that's big in the, that's big in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
But.
Because the entire rest of the movie is them talking about, oh my God, what happened with this? It just astounds me how stupid they make the people at the Metropolitan Museum of Art look.
Yeah.
You know, and it was so bad that at the end of the movie, they had a disclaimer that says, no museum endorses this. Did you notice that at the end credits?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. It's like...
But that's funny.
Yeah. And so what... It's pretty cool to see him, like, jump in there and take the painting and break off the frame and then essentially put it in his own briefcase that's been a specially made canvas transport and then just stroll out of there right past the cop as he's walking by.
I mean, it's a very slick scene.
Oh, yeah.
And, it looks great. I enjoyed watching it, but then I was thinking about realism and I was like, this isn't realistic at all.
And well, part of the movie industry is that you want it to be realistic up to the point of having your cake and eating it too.
Right.
There's a certain je ne sais quoi about the movie industry where they're like, we're going to push it as far as we want, and then we're just going to make everything else up, and you're going to accept it.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain amount of fantasy that goes into any heist movie or thriller movie. But this wasn't a particularly well-done heist that could even live up to the fantasy.
I agree.
One
of the things I wanted to bring up that is a big thing for me, not with the film really, but just with art in general, there's a big emphasis in the film put on the fact that the piece of artwork that was stolen is worth $100 million.
Yes.
To which I'm thinking, while I'm sitting there watching the film, how is a piece of artwork worth $100 million? Is it because of the fame? Obviously, it's all societally created hype,
right?
Which makes it worth $100 million.
Part of it is the fame of the painting, but this film, in the parlance of the film, that particular piece of art was worth the amount of money that it was because it was the first of the Impressionist movement. They say pretty explicitly, this is the painting that kicked off Impressionism. So because of that, it is a unique piece of artwork. The fact that it was as well maintained as it was made it another important piece of artwork. Also, cultural consensus does have a lot to do with it, but the supplies that go into art make it worth something. Art is something, it's something that's very important to me. I wanted to be an artist for a while when I was younger, and I considered going to art school because it is an expression of culture that everybody can look at and not necessarily agree with, but it can, it shows us things about ourselves. Art is less about what's on the medium as what it makes other people, what the viewer think about and how it's supposed to help us reevaluate our lives.
Right.
And in that way, film is art too, in a certain regard. Yeah.
And the interesting thing to me is that when you look at a painting, the right. painting realistically, like in reality, in not in society's reality, in
right.
real world reality, it's a canvas and it's paint.
Right.
And it's just put in certain pattern.
It's just blobs of ink on
exactly. Something. But to society, we create an image of it. You know, we make an image out of it.
Right.
That becomes a societal consensus, which makes it worth all sorts of money because you imbue it with all these societal values.
Right. Well, I mean, art's not the only thing that we do that with, though.
Oh, we do it with everything. We do it with people.
People, money, the idea of safety is a huge societal constraint.
Yes, you're right. And I just want to talk about that because I want people to be aware of what we do as mm-hmm. a society, and it's everywhere. And as you're saying, you know, it's not just with art, it's with people and all sorts of things. And I, in my life, strive to make people think a little bit harder about what they think reality is, because reality's not reality.
Right.
The reality that we live in is a societally constructed, quote, reality. It's all mental.
Yes. I mean, the thing is, culture is a group of agreed upon imperatives that we have come up with so that we can function as a large scale group. That doesn't mean that culture is necessarily inherently good, but it means that that we understand that certain things are supposed to work in certain ways. And then, like I said, they're not necessarily good ways to work. And in fact, there's a lot of things about American culture in particular that is pretty deplorable if you look at it just below the surface from what we say is a good idea. I think that's one of the things that the movie was trying to get at, was that the arbitrary assignment of a dollar number to art is something that's fairly classist in general.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, it was, the film was in and of itself a celebration of classism.
Right.
So yes. so it was kind of contradicting itself.
Yeah. The interesting thing is Dennis Leary's character, the police officer, at one point makes an interesting comment at the very end when the other piece of artwork is stolen. He basically says something to the effect of, look,
it's dabs of paint.
Yeah. On he puts canvas. No value into art, really. He's like, it's just, you know, it's a canvas with some paint. He's like, I honestly don't really care about catching the person who took it.
But rich people do.
Right. He's like, what I care about is getting the people who are committing real crimes, you know, domestic violence, drugs, murders, things like that. And that is kind of more along the lines of my thoughts on things, because when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, somebody steals a piece of artwork. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to the world? It really doesn't mean anything bad to the world. It's all in people's heads.
Right. But another thing that you would think about to consider is, if somebody is willing to steal a piece of art, how is that person willing to treat other people?
Well, I mean,
you know,
I agree with that.
Because
corporations steal money from people all the time.
All the time. Yeah.
And nothing's done about it.
Exactly. Well, and in fact, they're actually rewarded for that.
Yeah, yeah.
I would argue that a lot of, and this is me getting political because I've, as a contractor, I'm feeling the brunt of this at the moment, but the healthcare system is completely screwed up in that we have to buy this imaginary thing called insurance. You know,
it's paying protection to the mob.
Exactly. Exactly. If you don't do this, we'll break your legs, and then we'll also charge you, we'll slap more fines on you because you didn't pay your money the first time.
It's a way to create more jobs and to make sure that there's a sector of the economy that adds more money into the overall economy. Yeah. And that's the insurance sector. Is there really a need for insurance? No, not at all.
Right.
But politicians, our society, has created a niche for them, which can't be undone at this
and it's
point.
And it's one of the largest special interest groups.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Really, it is. And I don't mean to get political, and no disrespect to people who work in that field, but as someone who is living in a high cost of living state, health insurance is something that is really scary, especially as a younger person. I'm sure when I'm older, you know, I'll appreciate health insurance in a different way.
Correct.
But right now,
it's crazy.
It's crazy. And it's a culturally established fringe benefit of employment that doesn't really mean anything, but we're paying money for it.
And the corporations, the insurance companies only make money.
Right.
I mean, they have to pay out at times, but they're never going to be in a situation where they're not overall making a bunch of money.
And also the things that they can deny, they used to be able to deny you health insurance for. Oh, you've got this pre-existing condition? Well, we're not going to insure you, which means you're essentially going to die faster.
Which is interesting because the whole idea of capitalism is that companies take risk.
Yeah.
When they're doing anything business related.
Health insurance does not take risk.
Well, didn't. No. They're being forced to now, which yes. I think is better. But the fact that at one point they were allowed to just not take risk at all and only accrue capital was asinine, beyond asinine. So anyway, that's another thing.
We need to have Carlin and Jordan's most excellent political debates.
Yeah, that's the next one. That actually segues just fine into introducing Rene Russo's character because she works for an insurance company.
She is a art insurance investigator.
And a high-class prostitute.
Essentially, yes. Because she is not unwilling to use her body to solve the crime.
Well, and here's the thing. When I was watching the film, as soon as she shows up, it focuses on her legs and the stockings she's wearing. And she's very sexily, if that's even a word, dressed. She looks like a high-class prostitute.
She's wearing like a mink stole and very fine pearls and oversized sunglasses. Everything that you would establish as a cause celeb or a high-class lady of the night to be wearing.
And in that case, it bothered me because I'm like, here is the only significant female character in the film being objectified immediately before you even see her face.
The film fails the Bechdel test.
Yes.
Fails the Bechdel test hard.
And that was something that really bothered me about it. But it's interesting because I was talking to my father about that after the fact. He has seen this film, but it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And I had told him my idea on that, and he said, well, aren't insurance companies and insurance agents basically high-class prostitutes anyway?
And your dad's a lawyer, so he would know.
No, he is not a lawyer.
Oh, I thought he was a lawyer.
He works at a large law firm. He is the executive director, so he works with about 144 lawyers, I believe. So he knows about law-type stuff because of that, but he is not himself a lawyer.
Okay, my mistake. I thought he was.
But he's around it all the time.
Oh, yeah. So he knows. I'm sure he's very familiar with law just in
a... But I thought that was a very interesting take from him.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I can kind of see that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I really don't like it when the only strong female character... Well, the only female character really is just immediately objectified and kind of treated like just a sex object.
Yeah. It, well, especially a little bit later in the movie... at the black and white ball, there's about a 5-minute scene of nothing but her shimmying around.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my gosh, this is painful to watch.
And the other thing is at first she acts like she's a strong character. She really does. She's like, I'm going to catch you, Thomas Crown. I know it was you. I'm going to get you. Your, you know, manly wiles are not going to work on me. Which you're like, okay, you know. But then that breaks down really fast.
And you know what she says that's very contradictory to this tough as nails, I'm a woman who knows how to handle my business perspective, is when her idea of how to get Thomas Crown to confess to stealing the painting is that she's going to wine and dine him, essentially, and spend the night at his house and everything like that.
But
and
that turns into wine dine in 69.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really, it does.
But the thing about it is, what that said to me is, here's a strong character, and she's like, I'm doing my job.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it just devolves into, well, more important than doing my job, I need penis.
Yes.
And yeah. It's like, come on.
And but the thing is that the first line of the movie is the psychologist asking Thomas Crown how he feels about women.
Right.
And he's like, oh, I love women. As a sex object, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And then when they're having dinner together, him and Rousseau's character, I'm trying to find her name in my notes.
Is Catherine.
Yeah, Catherine.
I don't know her last name.
Barning. Olds Barning, I believe it is. But she says, Catherine says that men make women messy. You know?
Which is vice versa.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that when you start caring about other people, then you immediately stop. Your guard has to come down.
Right.
You know? And really, the way that she approaches this, it doesn't seem like she has any problems letting her guard down for the ends to justify the means.
Right.
But she takes it too far.
Filmmakers, please understand that when you put stereotypes in a film or you are constantly portraying any racial group or any gender, or I'm sorry, any sex, it wouldn't actually be gender, any sex in a certain light, you are informing the public.
Yeah.
Because films are very, very important to society, and they are looked at, and if you see enough of a stereotype, people start to kind of fall into believing those things.
Yes.
So please be aware of this kind of stuff. And one of the things I really want to point to as a perfect example of how film informs society is romance.
Yes.
A lot of people's preconceived notions about what romance is and what romance should be to them comes from film.
Yeah.
And that's not real life.
No,
it's not. It's very sanitized and it's very fantastical. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I actually wove that feeling about it into my wedding vows. And I don't actually have them. I mean, I do somewhere, but I don't have them for the podcast.
Right.
But I basically said something to the effect of, you know, this is what I think love is, and
right.
That's why I'm getting married, because it's contrary to what you see in film. You know, a lot of people believe that this is love and that this is love because of what film portrays, but this is what I believe it actually is. And it's not effortless, and it's not constant fireworks going off all the time, and no one's going to show up and sweep you off your feet immediately. And love at first sight, I'm sorry, it's BS. And you know what I mean? It's all these things are things that you see in film, and people are looking for that.
Yes.
So I think it sets everyone up to fail in love, in relationships, because they're always looking for it. And they're like, if it doesn't live up to the ideals that I've been informed of from film, then it's not actually love, and I need to keep looking.
Really, honestly, the thing is that people need to remember about relationships is you've got to be comfortable with who you are as a person before you actually pursue a romantic relationship.
And I would argue that everything in life goes back to you being comfortable with yourself.
Yes.
If you don't understand who you are and what you need and want in life, you can't make informed decisions. You can't make confident decisions.
Right. Right. And also, I mean, the thing is, if you're rushing into a relationship because it seems fun, or, you know, it just seems like you should be in a relationship because all of your friends are in a relationship. And I've seen that happen to people more than once.
If you're doing it, you're doing the wrong
thing. Right, exactly. If you're doing it, you're doing the wrong thing because you're treating the other person like an end. You're not treating them like a person who has needs and wishes and vulnerabilities. You're treating them like an object that you're going to control in and of itself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And that's where we really come into a hard thing about the movie is that, you know, they treat Catherine's character as someone who is seeing Crown as a goal, not as a person.
Right.
You know, and if it was just a business movie where she's tracking down the stolen painting, that would be fine. Mm-hmm. And I think her character would be more interesting that way. Although she is a bit of a snob.
But the thing is, it turns into romance.
Yeah.
And he's still using her, but she can't not love him. She can't separate her feelings from him and have it not, you know, screw up her job.
Right.
Basically. And in the end, he wins.
Yeah.
And because he double wins. He steals a painting, and he doesn't get caught, and he gets the woman.
He gets his cake, he eats it too.
He gets everything.
Yeah.
And, God, it's kind of maddening.
But I think this movie actually is Pierce Brosnan's wish fulfillment.
Could be.
You know?
He's like, I want to get with Rene Russo.
Well, not only that, but I think, you know, the thing is to be seen as someone who is in control all the time, you know, and gets to live a dangerous lifestyle. Like, there's a catamaran race in the movie. That's really dangerous looking.
Oh yeah.
It was actually a fun set piece in the movie to watch. One of the things that I liked about the movie. But you can tell immediately that he's doing his own stunts. Brosnan did his own stunts for that scene.
Nice.
So it's kind of wish fulfillment that he's, you know, he's the billionaire golfer who can throw $100,000 away on a single swing of the putt. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the guy who can steal the painting. He can get the girl who's hunting him, you know, and then he can steal the painting that she says that she wants as a way to
keep her close
and to show her that he emotionally cares for her. That, I'm going to break the law for you because I care for you.
Yeah.
Which,
by the way, rich people in breaking the law and taking because they want to take,
yeah,
is something that I did want to talk about because I had written down, what does a man who's filthy rich do? He steals.
Yeah.
Which is kind of true to life because there was a social experiment that was done not long ago that I had heard about, really interesting, where they had people come in, they told them they were going to be part of an experiment, and they had them wait in a waiting room.
Right.
So people believed that they were waiting in the waiting room to get into the room where the social experiment would happen. But the real experiment was in the waiting room.
Right.
Where they were being taped, and they had a candy bowl that had a limited amount of candy. They would say, okay, can you wait in here, and while you're here, feel free to have some candy, but please only have one piece, because that's all we have left, and we have other people coming in. We want to make sure that everybody can have some. So what they found through that is the people who were more wealthy took more candy.
Yeah.
The people who were less wealthy took one piece or none.
Typically, people who are less financially stable are the people who are more willing to help other people.
Because they understand.
Yes.
Because they themselves are not so rich and wealthy. They understand that situation. So they're more apathetic. Sympathetic.
Sympathetic.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
they're definitely more, not apathetic.
They're more sympathetic to the needs of
yes,
others.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, you have people who are rich, they have everything they want, they get what they want. There is a sense of entitlement that comes with that.
Well, and also the thing is that you see this entitlement with Crown when he donates a painting back to the museum as a replacement for the one that was stolen.
And actually it was, you know, painted over top, and it was the actual stolen
painting.
In
watercolor.
Which I really liked that twist.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome. It was interesting. And the part where it finally, like, gets washed off, the other paint, and it's revealed that the painting was there just 2 days after it was stolen.
Yeah.
And it was there for who knows how long.
Yeah, because he stole it for the risk, not anything. But the thing is, by returning it that way and having the watercolor wash off, he essentially damaged the piece of art that he claimed to love.
That's true.
He did. You know, so that in and of itself is an interesting twist there. Because he ruined a quote-unquote $100 million piece of art for his own entertainment, essentially.
Which is what rich people do. entitlement. Yes. I can do what I want to do.
Exactly.
You know? A few small things that I wanted to point out about this.
Just lens flares. Lens flares all over the place.
Yeah, that's true. It was a little excessive.
Yes, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just had to throw that
in. Hey, no. That is totally fine. A few extra things I want to throw out. Small notes. Amazing Pepsi One product placement.
Yes. I noticed that too.
It is so blatant. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's because she only drinks like grass drinks.
Yeah, Rene Russo's character, Catherine.
Catherine only drinks
like wheatgrass.
Wheatgrass stuff, which looks like stuff that you drink on a regular basis, but I know that
I
you
do.
You actually enjoy that type of thing. She's drinking it because she feels guilty about who she is.
And I just got a Nutribullet, so I will be drinking more of that kind of stuff, making it myself this time.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she breaks from drinking this and she runs to a soda machine and gets a Pepsi One. Make sure that it's facing the camera, says clearly Pepsi One, and starts chugging it so it's easily
able to be seen. Because that's her form of rewarding herself when she makes a big break on a case.
Yeah, and I remember when I was watching that, I'm like, ah, product placement.
Yeah, I had the same thought. But it also has an interesting thing because I have heard that there's been a change in our culture where people are more prudish about the food that they put into their bodies than they are about their sexual appetites.
I agree with that.
You know, so she's very prudish about drinking like the green drinks, for lack of a better term. I'm sorry, I'm totally trashing all over your diet.
No, I don't care.
But she punishes herself in what she eats and how she behaves, but then she allows herself to be very indulgent sexually.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting
dichotomy.
Because as a chubby guy,
he's rubbing his stomach.
Oh my goodness.
We all do.
Yeah. But we all have gluttony issues one way or another.
I agree.
But anyway, enough harping on Catherine.
Another thing I wanted to point out, something that really bothered me. It's small, but it really bothered me. There's a scene later on in the film, they cut back to the therapist and they start talking about porcupines. It's an analogy of Thomas Crown to a porcupine.
Yeah.
Basically talking about, well, how do porcupines make love, you know, carefully, whatever. And at first I was like, oh, you know, that's fine. That's a good porcupine analogy. And then they spelled it out at the end of talking about it. They totally spelled it out. And I was just like, really? People are smart enough to figure this out.
And that's my biggest complaint about this movie is that it thinks it's smarter than it actually is, and it preaches to the people a lot.
Yeah, the Trojan horse thing.
Yes.
This porcupine thing, that just drove me nuts because I was like, I was on board with the porcupine analogy, and then they spelled it out, and I'm like, really? You just ruined it. You just undid everything that you just did with that analogy. That if you want to ruin an analogy, spell it out at the end, and that's how you do it. You might as well, if you were going to spell it out, you might as well just not even have had the analogy in there.
Another thing that the movie does is it harkens back to the picture of the famous picture of the man whose face is covered with an apple and he's wearing a bowler hat.
Yes.
The way that they return the painting, quote unquote, return the painting, is that they flood the museum with anonymous businessmen in bowler hats, which is what Catherine actually calls Thomas Crown at one point.
Right.
So that was an interesting...
I like that.
That was a cool twist.
That was a cool twist. I did enjoy that. The last thing that was a big problem for me, that I know was a problem for you, way too much Thomas Catherine time on screen. Directors cut the fat, trim the fat, especially in films like this. Brevity is important.
We didn't need to see them flying all over New York in a glider. We did not, and honestly, the sex scenes in this movie were just gratuitous.
Yeah,
there was no reason to show that much sex.
Honestly, I mean, there's a montage of scenes put together with Catherine and Thomas spending time together that span, I don't know, like 15, 20 minutes, and you could have cut it to 5. And you got the point across within those 5 minutes, no problem. Move on. Trim the fat, please.
Yeah.
That was...
The film was 2 hours. The film was 2 hours, and it only needed to be an hour and a half.
I agree. I totally agree with that. That was just one... That stuck in my craw.
Yeah. So we're getting close to time here, so let's go ahead and quickly give our ratings, and then I have something I want to share.
Okay. I will say Thomas Crown Affair. It's fun, as heist movies usually are fun. It's not a typical heist movie. Obviously, I aired my grievances about a lot of the issues, the stereotyping of Rene Russo's character and making her just flat Stanley, as we said.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, the police and the security people were just idiots. You know, too many on-the-nose things, thinking it's better than it really is, having too much fat to trim in the film. There are a lot of bad things about it, but it's also a fun film. And the character of Thomas Crown was very interesting and engaging. The actual aspects of the heist were pretty interesting, like the little smoke bombs that he used at one point.
Yes.
The slick scene of him running in, grabbing the piece of artwork off and folding it up. You know, there are a lot of cool aspects to it, too. And then the painting being returned and then, you know, using the sprinklers to reveal that it was there. You know, it caused some inner turmoil for me to be like, I really like these aspects and I really hate these aspects.
Yes.
And the music was awful. Overall, I wanted to like it more than I did, but all of those small things that kind of pissed me off added up to me just falling in the middle. So I'm going to give this 2.5 stars.
Okay. I'm also going to give it 2.5 stars. I just thought that the movie was a wasted opportunity to do a heist movie. In heist movies, I love heist movies. I've talked about this before on the podcast. I think heist movies have an interesting dynamic to them.
I actually liked the remake of The Italian Job much better.
That's a really great movie. The remake of The Italian Job is a really great movie. Norris kind of phones it in, but that's because he was doing it for contractual reasons.
Right.
But this movie is trying to be too clever.
Right.
And if you have the thing is, you don't have characters interesting enough to be that clever. Well, that's not true. The main character, the viewpoint character of Catherine, was not interesting enough. Thomas Crown was a very interesting character, was a Mary Sue, but was still a very fun Mary Sue. And I would have loved to have watched the movie from his perspective of him being one step ahead of them, rather than them being one step behind him. And I think that's a very damaging narrative choice that they made that really threw the movie under the bus in a lot of ways. It is too smart, or it is too on the nose, like with the horse. And also, if you didn't pick up the guys in the bowler hats from the foreshadowing that they gave it, because it was very blatant foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Then, you know,
yeah.
You know, so in the movie, the music was horrible. The score was just, it was the worst part about it. The lens flares really distracted me. 2.5 stars is as best as I can do.
Yeah, I know. I even considered going down to 2.
Yeah, it was, I felt like 2.5 stars was generous.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
So, but anyway, speaking of generosity, the podcast has received several iTunes reviews that are 5 stars.
Boo!
Bam! So I thought I would go ahead and share one of those episode. This is from Heath, and Heath is a longtime listener of both Most Excellent Movie Night and Bone Throwers Theater.
This dude, Heath, is awesome.
He is amazing. I've actually got to do Google Hangouts with him a couple of times.
Nice.
Yeah, and he's a lot of fun to just hang out and talk with, and he's got a lot of interesting ideas, and a really cool guy to talk to. Much respect for Heath. And he wrote a really cool review that I'll go ahead and read for you here. From Heath, "These two know how to review a movie. They have solid ideas about what they like and why they like it. I don't always agree with their opinions, and they don't always agree with each other. But they support their opinions well and make me think about why I might disagree with them. They keep their movie selection to Netflix lineup so that the movies are available to a broad base of people."
And that is, in the very beginning, something we talked about before we did the podcast, because
yeah.
We even considered doing films in the theater.
Yeah.
And I said, for us and for the audience, let us keep it to Netflix streaming, so it's the most affordable we can get.
It is. And really, the crazy thing about it is that with the way that Netflix rotates movies in and out all the time, Sometimes we have to be careful. Like, sometimes I'll go, oh, I want to do this movie.
And then it's not
and
there.
And then it's gone.
Yeah.
There was a documentary you wanted to do. And it, like, you said, I want to do this. And then it was gone within 3 days.
Then it disappeared.
Yeah. Yep. But it's back now, by the way.
Which one was it?
It's the America in Black and White. Or
Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a documentary about the horror genre and the genesis that's taken over the decades.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
So anyway, we wanted to say thank you very much for the 5-star review.
Yeah, thank you, Heath. You are a major dude.
Yeah, yeah. So much kudos for that. If you have any more movie suggestions, because we're going to actually be talking about one of Heath's movie suggestions in the near future. By the way, Jason, thank you very much for selecting this movie for us. We do appreciate all the fan selections that we get. We don't always review them positively, but we also don't review them negatively all the time as well. A great example of this is Once Upon a Time in the West. We reviewed that one very highly.
Safe.
Safe very low. Was fairly low. but they all balance out.
Yes,
you know.
Do.
So...
How about this idea, Jordan?
Okay.
If somebody gives us an iTunes review and they submit a recommendation for a movie to do, should we jump that immediately to the top?
I think so.
Let's do it. You heard it here first. If you give us an iTunes review and then you send us an email at mostexcellentmovienight@gmail.com telling us a movie you want us to review, we'll jump that to the top of our list.
And that will come before even our selections.
Yep.
So there you go. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to Most Excellent Movie Night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your another movie for us.
You've been listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night.
Our theme music was provided by Sweet Wave Audio. To find more royalty-free music for your own projects, check out sweetwaveaudio.co.uk.
And special thanks to Ariana Ramos for her graphic design savvy helping us with our album art.
Visit our website at mostexcellentmovienight.com to listen to other episodes, give us your opinion, and share with us other movies you'd like to have reviewed.
You can also contact us through our email address, mostexcellentmovienight@gmail.com. We would love to read them on the air.
Also, if you could rate and review the podcast on iTunes, we would be your friends for life.
For sure. That's all for now. Thanks for listening to Carlin and Jordan's Most Excellent Movie Night,
where movies are most excellent.
This has been a Nerd Circle podcast production.